On this episode of the Creativity in Motion podcast, television producer Brett Walcott.
The moment you give your team a sense that you've lost even your own confidence, that's when chaos happens. Mm-hmm. And that's when people think, oh, I need to take over. You know, and it's not about control. It's about getting the problem solved.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Chris Hollow.
My name is Mark Masri, and this is episode number 22 of Creativity in Motion, a podcast about creativity where we talk with creatives of all kinds to find out why they create and especially how they use creativity to overcome obstacles.
In this episode, we'll be talking with producer Brett Walcott.
Before we get started with Brett, I need to tell you about our sponsor, Nosy College of Art. Nosy College opened in 1973 as a fine art school and has transformed into Tennessee's only private art college. They offer a bachelor's degree programs in commercial illustration, graphic design, video and film, photography, and a brand new culinary arts associate's degree. They have a beautiful 55,000 square foot facility that was built with the artistic student in mind. It includes computer labs, production suites, photography and video studios, and a fully stocked equipment cage. Everything students need to get creative. To learn more about Nosy College of Art, you can visit nosy.edu, that's N-O-S-S-I.edu, for degree program details, faculty information, and student work. And if that description made it sound awesome, it's because it really is a fantastic school.
Very cool. Let me introduce you today to our guest. Brett Walcott is an independent television producer working primarily on live programs like award shows, live music events, reality TV, and talk shows, but he also has worked on commercial and corporate jobs, as well as for clients such as HGTV, CMT, Bravo, and the Opry Entertainment Group. He's also a founder of the incredibly successful production company High Five Entertainment. Brett, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Did we get all that right?
Yeah. Gosh, what an amazing summary. It makes one realize how quickly time passes.
You've done a lot of stuff.
We have. It's always a we, I guess. Mm-hmm. For you guys, probably it goes fast because you typically have your head down and you're just trying to do the best you can in the moment for that month, for that week. And then the next thing comes up. And then the only time you bring your head up is when the phone didn't ring and you think, oh, well, I'm 30 and it's over now.
This is it.
Yeah. This is it.
Not a lot of looking back, a lot of looking down at what you're doing and a lot of looking up to see what's coming.
It's true. And interestingly, the looking back moments tend to come when you're trying to explain something to somebody, you know, either in a teaching moment or in a moment of problem solving. It's like, oh, you know what we did 10 years ago, maybe, you know, and then you realize that was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's nice to have you here, and your particular job requires you to, I know there's a lot of preparation involved with every event or broadcast or show that you're working on. So there's preparation on the front end, but I know there's a lot of seat of the pants kind of work that you do too. And we look forward to hearing all about that, but I'm curious if you could just give us a little brief overview of how you got to where you are and arrived at this point in your life.
Wow. How much time you got? Yeah. I think if I had to sum it up, I would say that it's about having a really firm vision for yourself. And in the case when you have your own company, as I did with two other partners, having a shared vision of where you're going, always be able to look, hopefully always be able to look and know why you're making decisions in the hopes that they will get you where you want to be. Now, that said, you also need to be able to be adaptable enough and flexible enough to shift your path, to shift your decision-making and the reasons why you make decisions, because your goals may change as society changes or as the industry changes or as you find a particular skill set that you as a group or individually want to pursue. Mm-hmm. And so it's a delicate balance, I think, because you can't be too namby-pamby about it because you'll never end up specializing in anything. But you also want to I think, at the end of the road, or at least I did, and when I had a company, we did, we wanted to be able to be multi-marketable. And so typically when you come out of, as I did from film school, you think, oh, we're going to make movies, you know, period. We'll make movies. Uh-huh. And you don't think about, well, Westerns or movies of the week or for TV or, now that seemed enough. And what you realize when you have a company that has mouths to feed, including your own, you can't just do one thing. Uh-huh. And, you know, because that one thing, just like investing in a stock, eventually is going to lose value or not be popular or whatever it is. And so you need to have other things that you do and hopefully you're good at and hopefully enjoy. I am here today and most of the work that I do, although not all, but much of the work I do does involve capturing musical content for TV. In the early days, we did that on film. And nowadays, of course, later on tape and then now on digital media. Was not what we, any of us in our company, set out to do. It wasn't even like a thought. And this is a good example of this, in a sense, where you need to let opportunity to be your friend while keeping your goal in mind, you know, your career goal, long or short term. So when we graduated from the USC Film School, myself and two other buddies, everyone gets cast out to the wind. You know, it's a little bit disheartening when you're in liberal arts because you rarely graduate with a job, right? You know, all your friends who are in business and petroleum engineering and they're in Kappa Sigs and all this stuff and they've got all these connections and they go off and start their lives at the bottom of the food chain in the mailroom and work their way up. And we were like,
right.
You got a little student film maybe under your arm and you're walking around town.
Like a couple of names maybe that you can call.
I didn't even have that. Some of the kids did, but I didn't have that. And so you don't really know where to start, you know, but you just know you got to do something. And so what we did was we each kind of, as I said, scattered to the wind. And I just tried to ply whatever trade I had that I'd learned in school. And that was camera work, which I really enjoyed. And there's several levels, you know, you can become an assistant cameraman or a loader in the days of film and all this. So you can kind of hopefully find a niche and work your way from there. Production management, producing, et cetera. And so I knew how to edit a little bit. Video editing had just become a thing then, believe it or not. This is in 1981. And so I got little teeny editing gigs for like doctor's offices that wanted to make films about their philanthropic work in Baja California or something. And it would pay like, you know, $200 for a month's worth of work or something. But my rent was $400 and I was sharing it with my girlfriend. So if I hit that $200 mark,
right.
All I had to do was find something to eat, right? And so you go. And so that I did that for like a year. I actually ended up getting recommended by a faculty member of USC to edit pornography, which interestingly, that was the first sort of creative decision you have to make where it's like, well, you haven't thought about having to make these decisions, which in many ways came up many different times later in life where you're like, okay, I have some sort of an ethical line about, you know, what you do and why you do it and with whom you're doing it. And then you also have the career line. And sometimes they don't drive, man. They go in opposite directions. But I ultimately decided, you know, experience is experience. And you don't know, you know, again, let opportunity be your friend. So you don't know what's going to lead to what. And so I took the job and interestingly, see, this is, he would never connect these dots, right? So I took the job and it was the guys that I was working with. I was actually a woman I was working for. It was a very famous penthouse photographer and she had ventured into the world of live action.
Performance.
Performance. Yes. And I must say she was exceptionally good at directing. So she rented space at this place called Gamillion Sound Studios in Hollywood, right in the center of Hollywood. Gamillion was owned by a guy named Ted Gamillion, who was a USC alumni. So there was an interesting connection. But they were in a holding pattern because they, and we're going back into film history here, they had been doing the post-production on a film called Brainstorm with Natalie Wood and
Richard Donner.
Yes, Richard Donner. And Christopher Walken was in that movie. But Natalie Wood had unexpectedly died due to a tragic drowning. And so all the companies that were working on that movie had to stop until they could figure out, are they going to finish the film? Is it a payoff? Is the insurance? And so this opportunity for this company I was working for to rent space for next to nothing helped out the studio because it got them a little bit of income. And here I am with all these people. It's like in the lunchroom, it's John Milius and it's Richard Donner. And and I was like, who would have connected these dots? Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that any of them like took a shining to me and gave me a job right away, but you get to sponge stuff in. You know, they had nothing to do for months, but talk about what are they going to do when they get back to work and what's their next project and how they felt about this scene and that scene. And, you know, and some of them I think would go back and like work on stuff, even though no one was getting paid. And so I could hear that down the hall, you know, it was really wild. But, and there's a whole nother story there. But the point of that story is it led to learning something that I never would have gotten had I not said yes. Mm-hmm. You know, apart from learning the craft of cutting pornography, which is in and of itself a craft, I got to learn all this other stuff too. And so anyway, there was about a year of just bouncing between lots of little jobs. And on one now very famous evening, myself and a couple of former film students, friends of mine, we were gathering at the place where you go when you have no money, but you want to go out. It's called the Old Spaghetti Factory. There's a whole bunch from Southern California. And for like the day, $6, you can get a salad and unending amounts of bread and big plate of pasta and a Coke and Spumoni at the end. And like you walk out of there feeling rich, right? And so we're all there sitting there and we are making a common complaint among ourselves about, you know, the worst part about going to look for work, you know, as a creative person is the time we were going to some of the networks trying to get funding for sports documentaries because we'd come from USC and there's this huge sports legacy and no one had really done a lot of stuff with that. Marcus Allen was there at the time. He was a big running back, Heisman Trophy winner. O.J. Simpson still hung around the school, believe it or not. And that was a good thing in those days. and so we were trying to sort of, you were saying earlier about playing off a name. It's like, well, you know, USC is all we got. So you go into this place. And we also were going to record labels looking to do this new thing called music videos, which, you know, MTV had just started in late 1981. And this is 1981 and 82, I'm telling you about here. And we were saying the worst part about this is you go to 10 places and maybe even 20 places. And one person finally says, yeah, let me set up a meeting with my boss, because you're meeting the right lower level people, right? Let's set up a meeting with Mr. Hart and tell him what you told me. And maybe we can work something out. And you're like, oh my God, this could be, you know, our first meeting. And so, you know, they say, well, go outside and talk to Brenda. And she keeps Mr. Hart's schedule and, you know, and we'll set it up. So you go out to talk to Brenda. And Brenda asks, you know, she takes all your information, your phone number down and all this stuff. She asks you the question that is so unintendedly belittling. She says, okay, Mr. Wilcott, who are you with again? And most everyone has an answer to that. Oh, I'm with CIA. I'm with, you know, XYZ Productions. And to have to say, nobody, it's just me. It just makes it feel so tiny. And so we're talking about this at the Old Spaghetti Factory. And somebody, it wasn't me, but somebody said, let's start a company to be from. Like, so we have an answer to that question. It doesn't have to be real, but all we got to do is print stationery and have cards. And then we can type thank you letters, you know, at the end. And thank you for taking the meeting. And yeah, we'll follow up with the whatever, whatever. And so we were like, so everyone like put their coins, you know, on their little crumpled dollar bills on the table. We had like $27 and one of the guys went out and like designed some very, you know, Melrose Place kind of looking stationery. And, you know, with the popular colors of the day, which was like purple and blue or something. And so that is how High Five Entertainment was born. That day at the old Spaghetti Factory, we printed out the stationery and then we all went out our business. We didn't, you know, we weren't looking out for each other. And there was a spoken but not written agreement that said, well, if anyone gets a job off of this, try to get the other guys,
bring them on. Sure. Yeah.
And if you can't, understood, no hard feelings, and we'll all do the same. And so it turned out that this would have been about December of 1982, April of 1983. So the Spaghetti Factory conversation was about December of 82. So in 83, we're having one of these meetings where we actually got a meeting, maybe because we were from somewhere. Who knows to this day? And it was at MCA Records, and it was to do a music video for Helen Reddy, who at the time had her star had already probably burned its brightest. Nobody knew it at the time. Mm-hmm. And she had come out with her second album after her highest selling album. And so they were thinking, we got to light a fire in this career. And so they decided to hire these kids to do a music video for. And so the guy was sitting there, and there was a couple, the two of us, the three of us total were sitting there. And he said, all right, yeah, let's do this. And this is, we'll give you the album. You can listen to the single, give us some ideas about it. And of course, we were going to make Casablanca, and, you know, we were going to make every great movie roll into this song called Imagination. And he said, now, he said, this is, I think, the first music video we've ever done. And so what do you guys need? And we all looked at each other and went, okay, we've never gotten this far before. Right. What do we need? So my very savvy partner said, well, usually under these circumstances,
right?
We get
historically.
Yeah. Like the other labels we've done this for, which would be none.
Right.
We get 50% up front as a sort of startup cost. Then we do all the work. And then when we deliver, we get the second half of the 50 on the backside. And he said, oh, and we also get, usually we get office space and supplies and phones and that kind of thing. And, you know, just to have a place to do this. And I thought, oh, be careful there because our stationery has an address on it. But the guy didn't bat an eye. He said, and he's writing all this down, you know. He was like a marketing guy at MCA at the time. And he's like, okay, studio, we can do that. We can do that with you. So long story short, to do this music video, which took us a month to do, they gave us an entire office trailer on the back lot of Universal Studios.
Wow.
Which is right next to Stage 27. I'll never forget where they shot Mermaid about a year later. And so we did the video. They loved it, and they didn't ask us to leave for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
We just stayed because we were like, well, we got nowhere else to go. You know, what happens if we just stay? And what was even stranger is, I guess, I don't know, you know, how it really worked over there, but all of our office supplies were free. We never paid for phones. We did pay a little bit in rent. And the guy that was kind of in charge of, you know, renting out all the offices and everything, I think he just liked us, you know, and plus we kept the place clean. Otherwise it'd be empty and he'd have to manage it and make sure that it wasn't leaking and all that. And so that's how we got our business started. Had that little fortuitous event not happened, A, doing a music video, and B, having literally nearly free office space for 3 years or so, that allowed us to be able to get enough income. So by the time they finally asked us to leave, the guy was super nice about it. He said, man, I like having, he was this Italian guy with all these chains and everything. And he was like, yeah, I like you having you guys here, you know, but we got like Knight Riders going on now. And we got this and the A team with Papard. And we got all this, I don't got any space. So I gotta get me our space. And so it's like, hey, man, it's cool. And so after that, we got like our first official, you know, as a regular tenant office space in a place that was actually across the street. So the whole point of that, probably overly long story, is I think maybe somebody a little too high in their ideals might have not even pursued a music video, or might not have said yes to a $5,000 music video, or might not have said yes to Helen Reddy, or I don't know what. But in essence, that job got us another music video, which got us another music video, which got us another music video, which got us to concert specials, which got us into PBS, which got us to NBC, which got us to CBS, which got us to ABC, which got us to HBO, which got us to Nashville. Mm-hmm. And all of that came from music. It got us for a couple of years, it got us a lot of work in the commercial industry. As you guys know, once MTV like really took off, and all of us that were making music videos in those Wild West days in those days, I mean, it was creatively, it was the Wild West. I mean, it was a trial ground for stuff that literally had never been done before. And you did it sometimes just for that reason, and other times it's perfect for whatever artist song you're working towards. And you can't do that in commercials, and you can't do that in feature films and that kind of thing.
Right.
And so we ended up working with a lot of feature film guys who liked that creative freedom, but also who liked having a gig that was only like 2 weeks instead of 6 months. And it was sort of fill in. And then it also helped us figure out how to be professional, because that's not something you get from doing student films. Yeah. And so that's the reason I tell you that, is because it's in a very broad stroke, it's kind of what got us away from movies. And while there were various points along the way when we wished maybe we had been able to pursue that, we did end up doing one movie actually in Atlanta, which is a whole nother drunken tale of despair. But with Evander Holyfield, which is another strange twist of fate. But I think it illustrates the point. It's like, let opportunity be your friend. And things happen. You just got to keep an open mind and you got to do your best work and be prepared, even if it's not the thing that you may think you're going to love or may think you want to do forever. You never know what it's going to lead to. You just never know.
That's our mantra.
Yeah. We've talked in terms of you never know for years. And the guy that's loading your lumber at Home Depot is a songwriter that you just never know.
Yeah.
You don't know who you're talking to. You don't know what's going to happen when you land, when you get there.
Especially in this town.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially in this town.
Yeah.
To that point, it's like for all listening out in podcast land here, Nashville is like no other town. Like, I cut my professional teeth in Los Angeles and came here in the 90s. But it amazes me, like, for example, a woman named Carrie Polly, who's now known as Carrie Edwards, who was Luke Bryan's manager, was our receptionist.
Right. In high school. Oh, really? Yeah.
And you know, and she was 22 or something at the time.
Right.
You know, and there wasn't a thing about her, nor would there have been, of her saying, you know what I want to do is I want to find an up-and-coming country singer and manage him and make him a big stadium star. You know, we're all just doing our thing, right?
Yeah.
And then slowly it happened. And then you're like, well, that's interesting.
Right.
Glad we treated her well.
Yeah. Carrie's great.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You never know is the reason that you take the job, that you have the conversation, that you decide to go the long way to wherever it is that you're going. You know, you decide to take the back roads instead of the interstate, or you decide to send an email to someone there's a pie in the sky chance that they're going to reply.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. You never know. You just absolutely never, ever know.
You'll always wonder if you don't.
Yeah.
You know, in the prep work I do for these Opry shows that I'm working on now, I can't tell you how often I come across the story of the guy. You know, Sam Williams is a great example, who writes Dolly Parton a letter. Even though he comes from a legacy family, he's a new guy, you know, and he wrote this song and he thought she'd be great. And despite all logic, he sent her this letter with the lyrics in it. And it was a very heartfelt letter. And she writes it back and says, yes, I'll do a duet with you. And, you know, that's from the pick me up off the floor department.
Right.
But you can't get a yes if you don't ask.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. You can't.
So here's what I want to know.
Sure.
You're a producer. The word producer can mean a lot of things, especially on film set. What would you say you do as a producer? Define producer.
That is the single hardest question to answer about a career, I think. And I'm sure there are others that are equally as hard.
That's why I want to know.
I've had to think about this so many different ways. And what I finally come to the conclusion of, and the reason it's so hard is because it means something different on every kind of job you're on. Mm. So a producer on a music video does a certain thing. A producer on a commercial does a certain thing. On a reality show, on a feature film, whatever. And then that's subdivided by who you're working with. A producer working with a particular director, that director has ideas about what he wants to share, what he wants to delegate, if you will, to the producer, what he expects from the producer, and vice versa. And so if you're a first time with a director or an executive producer, you got to figure that out. And everyone knows that. So how do you answer the question? To me, there is one single common thread between every single kind of work that a producer does. Your job is to usually take somebody else's vision, which is an intangible, and whether it's Coca-Cola or whether it's Paramount Pictures or Steven Spielberg or Kenny Chesney or the Grand Ole Opry, there's a vision for what they want to happen at the end of your job, what they want to see at the end of your job. And you have to create something tangible out of that. You're building a bridge between a vision and something tangible, right? It's an idea that has to turn into something real. And the process of doing that has to involve real things like money and time and people and resources and technology and all that. And all that factors into it. And that's what diverges between the different applications of being a producer. But that bridge that you have to build is always the first step. What is it that this person wants? And how can I translate that into something in the real world, you know, that can therefore make it happen? And that is my best answer.
So you're interpreting. I mean, we sort of do the same thing, I guess, with commercial still shoots and other commercial jobs is you have to get your head around what it is they need.
Yeah.
What will make them sign the check?
Mm-hmm. And, what's the win for them?
Yeah, exactly. How do you get to here? And then you process the things they're telling you. And a lot of times, let's be honest, clients don't know what they want. And they have a hard time telling you what they want, which makes your job of interpreting what you think they want even more difficult.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. That is, I would say, probably the next step after understanding you're building the bridge is figuring out what they want. And sometimes it's probably at best 50% of the time they can articulate that to you. And sometimes they can't. And that's okay, because that's part of your job is to help them figure it out. Ask lots of questions. Who's the audience? What's the win? What's the dream? You know, I always start with, what's the dream? It's like, if everything went perfectly, what's this look like to you? And then you work your way back from there, basically.
So I used to teach a business and photography class. And one of the things I would ask them is to try to help them ask all the right questions. Mm-hmm. Because invariably you forget one or two or 10. And then when the answer throws you out for a loop, it's partially your fault for not asking the question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I'd give them a hypothetical job. And they're all quoting the job. Like, we were working on estimating the job and they're all quoting the job. And the catch is it's in Arkansas, and not one of them will think, they all assumed it was in town and there's travel, hotel, per diem, and they just blew it every time, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, there's always something that you're not asking.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things that kind of keeps any producer, whether you're a student or whether you've been around forever, is like, that's what keeps you up at night. It's like, what don't I know?
What did I miss?
Yeah, did I miss? And it's especially unnerving when everything seems to be going well, because you end up with that little bit of time at the end of each day. Okay, you know, that's done. And then you think, what don't I know? What haven't I thought of?
I like the idea of the interpretation. And the thing is, I think the thing that makes your job hard is once you have the interpretation and you're sure you understand what they want, and then you go out and you say, okay, this is what it's going to take. These are all the things we need. We need these 20 things. This person, this facility, this location, you know, this piece of equipment, whatever we need, these 20 things. And they go, okay, that sounds good. And then you start making phone calls and you find out that 13 of those 20 things either aren't available, aren't in existence. It's impossible to get those. And so now you have to say, you have to keep the same interpretation, because that's the thing, right? Now, how do we get that with, we don't have these 20 things, we have these 7, and we have to replace these 13. And then of those things, 9 of them aren't going to be available. And you have to go down the list, down the list, down the list, until you find the thing, the combination of things that's going to allow you to produce it and still be mostly faithful to the interpretation that they communicated to you. That is an ungodly amount of stress and work and legwork to try and pull all that together. That's what we've found on our feature
film. It is. And that's, I think, what gives me cold comfort in those situations is hoping, to the degree that you can control it, that you are surrounded by a team of like-minded people. Mm-hmm. Most of the time you are, because most of the time you brought them on or you know them already. Not always. Because coming out the other end of that is the team figuring out the problem, figuring out the solution to the problem. And it's a relief and a joy when you actually see it happen, you know? You're right. I think there's always a delicate balance when you're interacting with your client, you know, who again may be a brand, or it may be, you know, the opera, or it may be a particular person, director, or whatever. You want to be able to set appropriate expectations so that by the time you get to the end of the process, they're getting what you had said you could do, and what they said they wanted. But the balance is not being so specific that every time you have to tack to the right or to the left, you have to then go back and say, okay, it's not going to be blue, it's going to be green.
Right.
You know, instead you say in the beginning, it'll be a primary color of some sort. You know, and that way you leave yourself a little room, as long as you're, you know, addressing their needs of what, that, as long as you're giving them a very sincere impression that you're on it and that you understand what they want, then usually you've got a little bit of a leeway. But, you know, that's the goal. It's hard to achieve that even within the realm of setting vague but specific expectations, you know, yeah, for your own safety, really.
Do you consider yourself to have like a forte or an area of expertise or something that you're particularly good at that might cause people to say, you got to get Brett Wolcott on this? Like, I know you guys need a producer. This job, you need Brett for this because he can do these things, as opposed to, you don't want this person or you don't want this person. You know what I mean? Is there something that people sort of know you for?
The best people to ask that is probably not me.
I have a good guess. You want to hear it?
Sure.
My guess is that you are not easily flapped. You're unflappable, because from the times that I've seen you working on live TV, you don't let things get to you. Like, I don't know that I've seen you lose it. And of course you don't lose it on a live show, because that's counterproductive, but
yeah, for sure.
But you seem to have a demeanor about you that probably gives other people who are nearby you some comfort that even if things aren't going well, that you're going to make it work. It will work. It'll be fine. And that was what I would guess people say about you.
Now that you say that, there have been others that have said that. And I probably wouldn't have thought of that had you not said it. I'm not sure why, but yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that's a reason to be hired, although it's helpful. But I think some of that just comes from within. I don't remember ever thinking, boy, I need to be calmer. Mm-hmm. But I do remember thinking early on, you know, when lots of things went wrong because of our own inexperience, to not communicate crisis.
Mm-hmm.
To the crew. It doesn't mean you say, hey, look over there, you know, while something's on fire. You know, you address it for what it is, but you don't ever communicate that you don't necessarily know what the next move is. You have to decide that pretty quick.
Right.
But because the moment you give your team the sense that you've lost control, or the moment you give your team a sense that you've lost even your own confidence, that's when chaos happens. Mm. And that's when people think, oh, I need to take over, you know, and it's not about control. It's about getting the problem solved. And that's key. I mean, I would, and I've spoken about that in different ways to classes, and you probably have too, to students, where it's like you really, that's why it's really important to be properly prepped, overly prepped. So when you walk into any situation, to the degree that is humanly possible, know the job.
Mm-hmm.
Because if and when something goes wrong, all that stuff's going to be necessary for you to be able to find your solution. And even if it's something tiny, you know, like somebody shows up late, it's not a crisis, but now you can't do everything you thought you were going to, you need to do in the amount of time that you had to do it in. So you have to know your material so well that, can I throw something out? Can I do fewer takes on something? So that you still, at the end of your now shorter period of time in this example, you get what, at least the minimum of what you need to get to have your success on the other end. And you don't get mad about it. You don't get, because as you said, it's counterproductive. And in the end, you got to be productive. That's what you're paid for.
I feel like being decisive, or not being indecisive.
Yeah.
Double negative.
Yeah.
If you appear to be indecisive, it just, people want to try to help and they want to try to fix your problem, which just makes things worse.
Yeah. And that comes from a good place, but you're right. That's another one of my sort of secret rules of leadership, is be decisive and be quick about it. But you can't be quick about it just for the sake of being quick. You have to, and this is something you develop, I think, you develop a sense of, when do I need to make the decision? And then you make it just a little bit early. So that people have time to filter it. And if it's in a crisis, the decision has to be made now. And sometimes in a crisis may be large enough where it's not just one thing, it's 10 things. And then you have to figure out what's the first decision that has to be made so that if you hit them out of order, you cause more crisis. If you hit them in the right order, you'll get the fire out.
Also, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's hard to make the right decision if you're not being calm. Being calm and just sort of taking it in and listening and making sure you understand the nature of the problem allows you to think about what the solution could be. And if you sort of absorb that crisis and take on the qualities of that crisis and get flustered, you're in a terrible position to make good decisions.
Yeah. And everyone suffers. And you guys, again, have probably been in this situation too. Another thing that is critical, I said earlier about not communicating crisis, you also don't pass it down. You don't always have the luxury of working for someone who is as calm as you. And so what you don't want to do, which is situations we've also been in, is have somebody rain some terror down on you, and then you turn around and rain terror down on your team.
That's right? The worst.
Because then everyone freaks out, and everyone is afraid of another reign of terror. And so you stop getting 100%. You just get as much as they feel like they can safely give you, which slows the process down, and you end up getting an inferior product at the end. And so that's probably one of the harder things in terms of, you know, pressure is to, if you're getting it, don't pass it on, absorb it. And that takes some fortitude. Like that takes some breathing, you know, to, and it might rattle you a little bit when somebody really leans on you, regardless of how legitimate or illegitimate it may be. But then to literally to turn around 10 seconds later and say calmly to your associate or producer or whatever, say, okay, here's what we got to do.
Yeah.
All right. We have 10 minutes. So I'm going to give you a 2-minute direction. You ask me if you have questions and then off you go. And then boom, boom, boom. Yeah. A, B, C, D. Go tell this person, go bring this person in here to me, make this phone call to that guy. Clear out the parking lot. We're going to need some vehicles, blah, blah, you know.
I had on my list of things to ask you about, which is about departments. And that feeds right into that because you have your own department. Other people have their departments. Mm-hmm. And like you said, if you panic and pass the grief onto your team, then
they may panic.
And there might be, you know, a big project. They may have departments under them. And then everybody gets sour. The day goes bad.
Yeah. It's my father was an aerospace engineer and he would call it a conflagration of failure. One thing causes another thing to fail, you know, like dominoes kind of thing.
Isn't that the word they used when the space shuttle went down?
I think it was because that was the actual truth. One small thing happened and it caused
an avalanche,
a series of events that became terminal ultimately.
I've heard that phrase before and I think it was related to the space shuttle crashing.
Yeah, it's apparently an engineering term, but it comes in handy.
Yeah.
Well, it must happen. I mean, it happens all the time, right? I mean, in engineering, in science, and if you're creating art, it's a constant process of failure until you figure out the solution or until you figure out, you know, what it's going to take to actually do what you want, right? And so you become very familiar with all the possible ways the dominoes can fall.
Yeah. Right? And I think sometimes people hear, you know, you in a class or maybe on this podcast or something, and they hear me talk and you guys talk and they think, wow, you know, how do I get to that place where I don't make mistakes? Mm. And it's not that. It's like,
it's not a place.
We sit here and we think and we feel confident and we, you know, we don't panic and all that kind of thing. But the key to that is understanding that you will make mistakes regardless of how much experience you have. But here's the real key. It's the next decision you make that makes it worse or makes it better.
Yeah.
And my analogy for that is at the time, it's like, if you're Tiger Woods,
I was just going to say golf is a perfect analogy.
Golf is a perfect example. He's an unbelievably talented golfer, but he's not perfect. Nobody is. So when he hits his ball into the woods and he has, and we hits his ball into the bunker and he has, it's the next shot that counts.
Yeah.
That's what makes him great is when he hits it out of the woods onto the green. When he has that amazing uphill chip out of the sand up onto the green, that's what makes him great. And when you think about that, it actually is kind of freeing because you think, oh, I can make mistakes, but I got to know how I got there so I can figure out how to get out of there. You know, that's what counts. And I, to me, at least that takes a certain degree of pressure off of yourself, you know?
I had a neighbor that was playing in a pro-am, and he is a scratch golfer. And he was playing with, I think, Hale Irwin, senior golfer. And at the end of the round, he said to Hale Irwin, he said, well, how many of those shots did you really think you hit well? Like, how many of those shots are you proud of? He said, five. And he shot like a 70. He was two under. And my neighbor goes, are you serious? Those are the only shots? How did you make such a good score? He goes, I'm just better at handling my mistakes than you are.
that is exactly it.
That was exactly it.
And that's a perfect illustration, a real life illustration of that very point, you know? And that's something I still think about a lot, you know, like when I'm right in the middle of something that is just going off the rails and I think, all right, you know, you breathe for a minute and you think, A, this, what happens after that? B, that, what happens after that? C, that, what happens after that? Which one is the least of the worst choices? B, I don't have time to get to D, E, and F because I'm running out. And so you pick it. And you know what? It isn't always the right decision, but you can look back on it and say, it's the best decision I can, if you can look back on it and say, it's the best decision I could have made with the information I had at the time. You know, and that I think at the end of the day is what you always want to be able to say to yourself, you know, that you were in the moment enough, ready enough that if you did make a mistake, it wasn't because you hadn't done your homework, hadn't thought it all the way through. You made it. And that's what they call an honest mistake, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and hopefully you get another shot to get it up out of the bunker after that.
On the creativity front, I imagine there's a lot of creativity that goes into keeping these productions on track and making sure that things happen at the right time with the right people. Would you agree with that? Or does the creativity aspect of your job seem like more of a strictly problem solving thing and the creativity happens during the preparation?
It's a great question. For me, it helps if you can have some understanding of other people's creativity. And so I guess to be able to do that, you have to have some degree of imagination where you can, back to the vision thing, right? You know, because as a producer, you do end up having to make a number of decisions without the visionary there. And you want to be good about reporting many of those or saying, oh, by the way, earlier today, I had to move the set piece back because it was casting a shadow right there. Are you cool with that? Oh yeah, good call, you know, or whatever. And so I think the more you are able to appropriately exercise creativity, it's helpful. It's faster. You can make better, quicker decisions. This gets into another area as well. We spoke earlier about being a producer meaning so many different things, you know, and there are some producers who, and this isn't a right or a wrong, you can make these same sort of delineations in photography or studio recording or whatever. It's like your wheelhouse is different than anyone else's wheelhouse. So you try to play to your own strengths, right? There are some producers who aren't as good at writing or editing or arranging, directing talent or whatever. And so if they're thoughtful, they will make sure they're covered for that in some way by having somebody with them, or whether it's a coach or an AP or even the director, you know, in a situation where they feel like they might not be able to contribute as much as they want. For me, I try to be aware of those things as well. And the one thing, I'm going to go around the corner a little bit to try to finish this answer for you, is the one thing I also tell students, and I try to do myself, and this gets to your department's question as well, is to be good at any job in the entertainment business. It is incredibly helpful to understand everyone else's job. Because almost any creative endeavor involves a number of people. And each person has a specific job, a specific link in the chain, if you will. And then when they finish that job, they hand that off to somebody else. Somebody's doing the recording, but that's usually not the guy mixing. So if the guy who's recording understands the job of the mixer, he'll probably give a better product to that guy because he knows what his parameters are. So it's a little harder to achieve that as a producer, but I constantly, I think film school sort of helped me understand this without me knowing it, is I try to understand everybody's job because I interact with everybody. lighting. This is true at the Opry too. Lighting, audio, the directing, literally the technical parts of the switching and how we get the signal out of the building to Atlanta and to India and to YouTube and to Facebook. It's like, I don't know enough to do it myself, but I understand the process. And so I can then be better at helping solve problems if I understand the process, because I'm more likely to make a suggestion or ask a question that's relevant and isn't distracting them and them having to then give me lighting 101 while they're trying to solve a problem. And so I think you need to be able to understand the creative process a little bit to A, understand those individual jobs, but also B, completely understand how they all work with each other. Because the moment something changes, and things always change, you got to figure out who needs to know this, you know? It's like, you know what? It turns out that Chris Jansen isn't going to be preset on the stage. He's going to walk on. He wants to walk on. And so, all right. Well, right off the bat, I know, okay, audio needs to know that, because if he's going to talk while he's walking, he's got to be holding a mic. It can't be sitting out in the stand out there, or if he's going to sing while he's walking. So maybe that's a question, maybe not. Lighting's got to know that, because they're expecting him out in the front circle and we're shooting him. He can't be in the dark. So we got to tell lighting. And stage manager has to know that, because he's going to freak out that Chris isn't preset and he'll think that somebody's forgetting something. And so you start going through your checklist. And the only way you come up with a good checklist is to understand what everyone's jobs is. You know, it's like, what's going to freak them out? So hopefully that answers your question. I know I gave an incredibly broad answer.
No, it's a lot of preparation, because you have to find out what everybody else's jobs are and understand that. And then when the thing happens that causes a red flag to go up, all of your preparation informs you as to what you're the most efficient and effective course of action is.
Yeah.
People that work in fields that seem like it's all just problem solving, like if this happens, then you do this. If that happens, then you do that. That's all preparation. And I think the creativity gets lost in there somewhere, or people don't realize how much creativity went into the preparation and the understanding of what that all means in case this happens.
Here's maybe another way to answer that question too, especially from a producer standpoint, is one of the other jobs that you have, and this is all about attaining the vision, right, is who do you hire? Do you hire cameraman A or cameraman B? Well, what are you doing? If I'm shooting a NASCAR race, I'm going to hire the sports camera guy. But if I'm shooting a music show, I'm going to hire the music camera guy. The first thing you got to know is that there actually is a difference. There are camera guys who specialize in, some do both, but most of the time they specialize in one or the other. Same's true in still. Food, children, women, cars. Like some guys, that's all they do. And so the same thing is true in this kind of a thing. And so part of the creativity, once you understand the vision and the job, you want to hire the people that will enhance that vision, right? And hopefully we'll then deliver at least primary win, if not, you know, of course my goal is always to over deliver, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that was an area with the Opry where we had to find what I call the learning curve of collaboration, because they hadn't done something on this scale before, where it's like, you know, especially during COVID, we were there every Saturday night. So they had an internal process of having video support for the screens, but what they didn't know, and that's okay because they didn't have the same masters to serve that I have to serve, is that the people doing the same jobs now need to do more. We expect more. They, meaning the Opry, expect more. And so there was a little bit of a dance and changing some of the, doing some additional training to a certain degree, and then changing some of the roles with people who specialize in those kinds of things. Whereas the people before were in their wheelhouse was not everything we needed to have, you know? And so that's an example of you have to be creative in the use of your resources. And that's not something you typically think about, because when you think about creative, you're thinking about writing and you're thinking about editing and you're thinking about something that is literally shaping and molding. But who you put in their various jobs is also a huge part of shaping and molding.
It's the Ocean's 11 team. You have every single person's there because they're the best at what they do.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And I'll tell you, it's a real charge when you get on a big NBC show and you can hire the A team for every single department. You know, you're just like, oh my God, what could possibly go wrong?
How deep do you hire? I mean, do you hire department heads and let them handle their own crew? Or do you get into their business?
If I'm on a ground up show, and by that I mean if I'm hired to do an award show or a red carpet thing or a music video, whatever, then yeah. Now I collaborate with, you know, with whoever my immediate superior is. So if it's a music video, then my superior is going to be the director and or owner of the company. And so I'll say, who do you like using for, you know, your DP or whatever? And then whatever that person says, because their name is really the one that's on it as much as mine, then I'll go with that. And if that person is unavailable or whatever, then well, I use this guy for this one. Did you like that? And did, you know, then you work it out.
Sometimes you hire the hazer guy, sometimes you don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's everybody though. I mean, so that's another it's another reason why it's kind of hard to break into the industry, because one of the other parts of a producer's job is to do everything you can to reduce risk of not attaining the vision, right? Mm. And so reducing risk usually means working with somebody that you already know, because you have the shorthand, you know what their strengths are, you know what their weaknesses, if any, are, and you play to that in each other. And so for a new person to come along and want to get into that Rolodex, if you will, that contact list, is kind of hard. And so what they're looking for is your guy to be unavailable. And then you're like, well, I could try this guy.
Right.
And there are ways to break through in that way, and there are ways to make yourself, you know, less risky, if you will. But it's not for any, you know, like, well, to me at least, it's not for any sort of exclusionary reason. It's because of this whole thing, you know what you're going to get,
yeah,
you know, when you hire the guy that you've always used or the woman that you've already used.
We've talked about failure several times. It's come up on several episodes, and mm-hmm, and how failure, depending on the job, I guess, failure maybe is an option, but usually it's not, especially when there's money involved and client, and they expect to get what they have ordered. And you mentioned earlier, I think off air, you were talking about failure and how there are, especially in the live situation, failure is not an option.
Yeah.
You have to, it will work. It will be on time. And you just do what you can.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a team mandate, you know. You can't be the only guy there with that with that vision, because you'll, you know, the town will burn down and you'll be standing there in the smoldering ashes going, what happened? You know, to me that's kind of the fun of it too, is watching something good come out of something bad, or something, or just finishing the race, you know, going out at 9 o'clock, you know, when the show's over. It's like, whew.
Did it.
Yeah.
Did it. At what point during the process of producing something do you feel most creative? I know you write. I know you go soup to nuts, so on a project sometimes. So at what point do you feel in the process that the creativity is happening, that you feel most fulfilled creatively?
Well, there's actually, whether you attended it to or not, there's two different questions in there. One is the point at which I feel most fulfilled, and the other is the point at which I'm being most creative, because sometimes those are different answers. Mm-hmm. Most creative kind of depends on the show. For the Opry show that I do, and any live show that I would do, as you said, I write all the host copy. I sometimes even write stuff for the WSM announcer when he or she, mm-hmm, has something that's going to make it to the network. Not always, but sometimes I'll write that. I write all the promos for the show. And so in terms of feeling the most creative, I think that is when I'm finished with it, not during it. I don't feel very creative in the middle of it, but at the end, especially after a few days pass and you reread it and you're like, I don't remember it sounding that good. That's okay. And again, in the live show scenario, and then the other part of feeling most fulfilled is when it works. Mm-hmm. You know, like the first part of that is when your talent shows up, sometimes 4 days after you wrote it, you know, and sometimes 2 hours after you finish writing it. And they say it, and it sounds like they just made it up. And I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't ask for anything better. And to me, I don't consider myself a writer. This is the first time I've actually ever written like everything, because I much prefer to have a writer on their show so I can focus on other stuff. Mm. But in the way this show came about, there just wasn't room and time, much less money for it. So it's like, okay, never say die. I'll do it and I'll just keep it simple, you know, stay in my own wheelhouse. And so when the show's actually happening and it looks like it's all working, like, you know, the light comes on, we come out of commercial and there's Bobby Bones or there's Natalie or whoever, and they're saying all these things. And I'm like, that sounds amazing. You know? And I would say that whoever wrote it,
yeah,
but that gives me fulfillment that it, that actually, you know, for a week, at least in the way of the Opry show, for the week, you've got this thing in your head. And it isn't until you literally see it where you think, oh, okay, well, that's going to work. And that's amazingly fulfilling. And then, and the other parts of it is too, is I'm fortunate enough that Dan and Gina and at the Opry, they include me in how they're going to shape the show, like who starts the show, who ends the show, who's in the middle of the show, how many songs they get, all this stuff. We work together. And ultimately, they, of course, have the final decision. It is their show. They are the Opry. But sometimes, you know, one or the other of us will have an idea. And it's like, well, let's try that. You know, yeah, let's try that. And then you see it. And it's like, wow, that worked even better than I thought. You know, and I don't know that anyone else would notice that, but because you don't know, like, the process that it took you to get there. But that's totally fulfilling. So that's one part of the answer. The other part of the answer is, when you're doing a show that is not live, then all the things I just mentioned are true, except now you go into post-production. And part of the game in a live TV show is to try to make decisions that bring you in on time and the show still looks professional and of the highest possible quality. When you're shooting a show to tape, you don't have the time constraint from the point of view of everything has to take only 60 minutes or whatever it is. You still have a time constraint of, like, it has to fall within the course of a day or a week or whatever you're doing. But you're also building a little house of cards that hopefully will still be standing when you get to post-production, mm-hmm. You know, and you're trying to, remembering what I said earlier, trying to create content that can be managed in an offensive way by the editor and the post-audio department, right? Offensive meaning they're not covering up your mistakes. Right. Offensive meaning they're making it better.
Right.
They're detailing the car. They're not having to build it or buff the scratches out.
That's a lesson we're learning on our feature film, is trying to shoot with the editor in mind, trying to organize the day so the DP is not having to move gear too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
All those little things help make the day.
And it's why collaboration is so important. You know, and a lot of times the freshies out of film school don't 100% understand that, but all that matters, time, energy, you know, it's not just a tradition. It's like how you get the best product, and compromise is part of the process as well. But if, you know, the trick is, of course, if you can find a compromise that gets you done at the 10th hour, gets you the pages you need to have shot, and you still get the spirit of the scenes that you were hoping to capture, maybe not the way it was on paper, but if it still comes out the way story-wise that it was supposed to, then that's your win.
Yeah.
I think my passion actually comes from, I love to tell stories, as you can tell by this podcast. And it's something I probably inherited from my dad, because I used to beg my dad to tell him, you know, we'd have a dinner party or a slideshow, and, oh, tell him a part about when we got stuck in the mud. And I'd just sit there, you know, like this, watching him tell this story. And so what I have come to either choose to believe or actually believe about all of life is that storytelling is a really necessary skill. I happen to love it as not only a necessary means of communication, but as a form of entertainment or infotainment or education or anything. There's just something that thrills me about being able to move somebody, whether it's a joke or you're telling them about a movie you just saw, but you don't want to give it away, but you still want to tell them enough to get them excited about it. And so, yeah, that stuff's always bouncing around in there. And I do think from time to time about something may strike me and I'm thinking, I bet there's a story there. You know, look at that guy. Look at that woman. Look how they do that. Like, how did he learn to toss the pizza dough like that? That's not from a YouTube. I mean, there's a story there.
Right.
You know, yeah. Or whatever, right?
We do that all the time. We're always processing and dismissing and filing away ideas and things that we either don't have time for or...
We'll get to later.
We know better.
Did you guys ever go to the storytelling festival?
Mm-mm.
You aware of this?
In Jonesboro?
Yeah, East Tennessee, right?
It's in Jonesboro, yeah.
Yeah, if you haven't been, you got to go. It's just, you buy a ticket. It's like a film festival except for storytellers, right? So they set up all these, have you been?
Yeah, I'm from Kingsport.
Oh, then you know. So I went there with a friend of mine who is now, who Will Akers, who's the guy that started the film program at Belmont. He was a student friend of mine at USC back in the day. And so he's always been talking about this. Yeah, gotta go. And I'm like, oh yeah, sure. So one day he calls up and he says, I got this extra ticket. You're coming. And so we get in this car and we drive forever, you know, to East Tennessee and stay in this beautiful old, the only like, you know, nice little old wooden hotel there. And we spend the next 2 days, rainy days, going from these big like revival tents, right? From one to the next. And for an hour, or maybe more, maybe for 5 hours, there's a series of people who get up for 20 minutes or half an hour, and will tell a story. And I didn't really know what to expect, you know. And sometimes the stories, it's kind of like the moth hour, I guess. They don't have to be true. They just have to be good stories. And sometimes there are these fantastical tales, and sometimes it's, you know, like very, like Will Be Gone-ish, you know. But in almost every situation, you're sitting there going, God, you know, this person's really got it. And like a film festival, after you mingle around for a bit, you run into these people that were telling the story up there. And I remember this guy telling me, I'm like, so you do this for a living? Or do you like work in a grocery store and this is what you do for? No. And I said, you can make money. Yeah, wow. And part of how he makes his money is not really, he or she is not really being in a tent doing this, but it's teaching storytelling to students and to teachers and all that.
Interesting.
And I came to understand this, something that I knew but never articulated to myself, and it was so important for me who loves to storytell, but what an important life skill that is. If you're applying for a job, what's the story you're telling? You're telling the story of yourself. You need to be a good storyteller to get a job. If you're the head of marketing somewhere, and you're trying to communicate the vision for the way forward for the Acme Feed and Seed Company, you have to tell the employees the story of how this is going to work. And so in life, we tend to hear the word story and we think of something fictional, but it's actually telling, arranging a series of points in an order so that when you get to the end, somebody understands an idea or a lesson or something like that. And I was like going, that is like the meaning of life. You know, yeah. And I thought, man, everyone should understand that, because everyone would, they'd be more thoughtful about how they communicate with each other.
Well, I don't know when that happens next, but we'll put a link to it on the show notes, because yeah. I want to go. And my first thought when I'm hearing about it is that it would be an interesting place to mine ideas or IP for a feature.
100%.
Like if you were a writer,
yeah,
and you went and heard like the story that connected with you, you go and option it from the guy who just recited it, and then you've got almost an outline for a feature.
100%. And hopefully somebody creative to flesh it out.
Yeah, it wouldn't be me to write it, but like.
And I don't think I've seen a doc based on the Jonesboro Storytelling Festival.
No, I mean, other than the little thing they do to get you to come to
promo.
The sizzle.
Do you know when it is? What time of year?
It used to be in October, right?
I don't know what's happened to it since COVID, but it's an annual thing and it's not going anywhere. It's just on hiatus because of COVID, but
it's a revenue generator for the town. So in fact, there's like an organization that sort of facilitates the business of storytelling, and the home of that organization is in Jonesboro, right?
Yeah. Jonesboro is the oldest town in Tennessee, and they play up their heritage as the oldest town in Tennessee.
At least that's how the story goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, but yeah. Yeah. We should definitely go.
I'm putting that on the calendar.
Yeah.
When we're done here tonight, I'm putting that on the calendar.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right.
It's, you know, I mean, I'm into this sort of thing, but I found it, you know, a life changing may be an exaggeration, but it's life enhancing.
Well, this is an excellent place to wrap up this episode. And we really appreciate you coming. I learned a lot of stuff I didn't know, and I got to know you a little better, which is pretty cool. And it's been great having you on the show.
Yes. Let's do it again.
Yeah.
Let's bring the whiskey next time.
That's right.
For all of our listeners out there, where can we find you online?
You're hard to find online.
Other than LinkedIn, I don't really have an online presence. And the reason there's no real deep, you know, like the camera sees into my soul issue with that. It's because as a producer, it's kind of hard to show your product, I think. You know, I mean, I can put up Coke commercials and music videos and that kind of thing. But I always feel weird about that because I'm not the only one who did it. It's like,
right,
you know, the director did that. I just made it happen for him. You know, I just gave him and the artist. And so I feel a little weird about saying, oh, I did this. Well, I helped a lot.
Yeah, but it's world building.
I mean, yeah, it is.
It's, yeah.
We can, it is. Hey, we can direct people to LinkedIn. I mean, that's a
start.
That's a good place.
That's what we'll certainly do. There's the ability to communicate there.
And if you don't have a LinkedIn account or profile, while you're there checking out Brett's information, sign up. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn mm-hmm. is a fantastic tool.
It's free.
Yeah. Another thing we do before we let you go is we like to ask one thing that we're looking forward to. Chris, what are you looking forward to?
Saturday night, I have a rare Saturday night off from the Opry. I'm going to go to a film premiere, a short film that a bunch of actors put together. They produced it themselves. They shot it themselves. And I'm going to go and watch a premiere that I'm looking forward to. How about you? What are you?
Wow. This is the hardest question of the entire hour.
Wow. Harder than what's a producer do?
Yeah. Well, because that one I've thought about.
It doesn't have to be profound.
Yeah. I echo Chris's sentiments. I have a rare Saturday off. And so, you know, spare time is like, you know, more valuable than Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I really think carefully at what I do with it, even though it might not appear that way if you drive by my house and I'm pulling weeds, but that's a choice. it's going to be getting two full days off and having that be entirely elective time. So what are you looking forward to?
Well, Chris and I have a meeting on Friday morning with a potential new commercial client, and we sat down last week and came up with a lot of really solid ideas for promotional still photos and videos for them. And it was a lot of fun to think conceptually, and so we've got that pitch on Friday morning, and I'm very interested and looking very much forward to having that conversation and seeing what they think of our ideas. So
we want to thank Brett for coming in today and also for our sponsor, NOCI College of Art.
Creativity in Motion is produced by the team at Penumbra Entertainment. If you like the show and you enjoyed hearing Brett Wolcott on the podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you really liked it, the best way you can support us is to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And if you listen on Spotify, you can rate the show right from the show's page in the Spotify app.
You can follow Penumbra Entertainment on Facebook and Instagram. On both platforms, we are Penumbra Films. To get show notes and information on the Jonesboro Storytelling Festival, you can check out our website, which is penumbra-ent.com.
If you have any questions for us, please, we would really love to hear from you. Just send your emails to creativity@penumbra-ent.com. We'd love to hear your ideas and thoughts about the show. And if you have suggestions for topics you'd like us to talk about or guests you think would be appropriate for us to have on the show, please let us know. We hope you'll join us on the next episode of the Creativity in Motion podcast. In the meantime, don't forget, sometimes your best creative work will come on the heels of your biggest mistake.